I'm Erwin Raphael McManus, and this is the Genius of Podcast. On today's episode, I have a special guest. His name is Ed Milet. Ed is an entrepreneur, a peak performance expert, and his focus is on helping people discover their genius and maxing out their peak performance. I met Ed through a mutual entrepreneur who's also a friend. His name is Edwin Ariave. Edwin reached out to me and said, there is this man you need to meet. He has an extraordinary ability to start companies, to help other people find their entrepreneurial capacity. And I just know that you would really resonate with him. Well, it took a little while, but when I met Ed, we just hit it off right away. I just love his passion, his intensity, his intelligence, his drive, and his belief in the capacity of other people. And so I want to invite you to join me now on The Genius of Ed Milet. Today, I have a special guest who is a new friend and an incredible human being. I'm so excited to launch this entire podcast with Ed Milet. Ed, it's so great to have you with me.
Erwin, brother, honored to be here and honored to be on the inaugural podcast. So this is wonderful.
Yeah, for me, it's so exciting to talk about the genius of Ed Milet. Now, I know you would not call yourself a genius, but it never hurts when someone else identifies the genius in you and wants to share.
I'll take it, especially coming from you.
You know, a part of our intent during this podcast is not only to unwrap a little bit about your genius and how you discovered, how you stepped into it, but also to help those who are listening to become more aware of their own genius and to have that genius within them awakened. And I know that's really central to who you are as a person. You've been focusing so much of your life on awakening and unlocking the greatness in other people. Now, I want to kind of begin maybe at the beginning of your story, and because you really do have quite an interesting journey. And now I noticed you were born in Diamond Bar, California. Now, if I just said you're born in California, that sounds really epic. Anybody knows Diamond Bar? It's just a kind of a small town and outside of LA. What was it like growing up in Diamond Bar?
Well, interesting. A lot of blessings. One, I was born in Boston. We moved there when I was very, very little, and I grew up there all my life. But one of the really unique blessings, you know, in hindsight, there's so many blessings in our life that are appearing in front of us. I just think, Erwin, you know this too, like they don't show up looking like we think they might look or at the time we think, or maybe they come at us in a difficult time. But one of the great blessings of my life was that down the street, there was this little Hispanic girl. And I came back from kindergarten the first day and I told my dad, I said, Daddy, there's a little brown girl in my kindergarten class. I think I'm going to marry her. That's no joke, Erwin. And I ended up doing that about 20 years later. And so one of the great things about growing up where I was is my wife grew up right down the street from me, actually a few streets over, but we went to the same elementary school and then started dating in high school. So, but growing up there was lower middle income, I guess is what you would say. But Erwin, you know, like most people, I don't come from a perfect family. I come from a loving family, as you know, and I know you know this, but my dad had a drug and alcohol problem my entire childhood and adolescence. And so I grew up in a loving home with good parents, but certainly a lot of anxiety, a lot of strife, worry, fear, you know, all those emotions that we probably would rather not experience, I did have as a child, in addition to being loved, but it was certainly stressful. I remember my dad, you know, yelling and me thinking, gosh, I wonder if the neighbors can hear all this, you know, and being ashamed and embarrassed a little bit in our neighborhood. So, but the good thing about my neighborhood, very diverse, African-American couple next door, Japanese couple next door, Indian gentleman lived across the street from us. Eddie Padilla lived two doors down, who's obviously, he was Mexican. And so I had a very diverse upbringing and learned a lot about different cultures growing up too.
Oh, that makes such a difference when you grow up with people who are different than yourself. It allows you to see yourself and others, I think, in a much more holistic way. But I also know that my father as well was an alcoholic, and I know that that creates its own dilemmas, creates its own challenges. I love the way you describe it, a loving home, but not a perfect home. What were some of the environmental dynamics that helped shape who you were as a person? Because a lot of times people see someone like you and they see you incredibly successful, very powerful, very confident. What was your inner narrative when you were younger? Did you feel that same way then?
What a tremendous question. No, the complete opposite. In fact, if I do exude a little bit of that now. It's because I had to work so hard, Erwin, just become a baseline functioning person with my confidence when I ended up going away to college, because I had none of it. But as you've said, you call it genius, and I'll accept that. It's very difficult to think about myself that way. But one of the talents I certainly have is my ability to read people and be present with them. I love people. And that was a great gift of having an alcoholic dad, because by the time I was about 4 with 3 little sisters, when my dad's key, I knew how the key hit the lock, Erwin, whether I got sober or drunk dad. I could tell by the sound, the key, and the lock.
Wow.
And when he would walk through that door, I would, because he would leave and go on these binges, my dad, and he'd go, "You protect your sister and your mother's." Like, I'm the man of the house at 4, right? But when he would walk through as a little boy, I remember looking up at him and thinking, I'd read him. Is this drunk dad who's going to be a little bit aggressive and I want to keep mom and the girls away from him? Or is this sober dad who's going to want to go play catch in the backyard and we're going to have a great time? And so I would read him and be present with him. And I think that's something to this day that is maybe one of the 2 or 3 things that I am still to this day utilizing in everything that I do, that maybe is a talent that I have that's unique, born out of that adversity because I had a dad like that. So I grew up insecure, fearful, worried. I'm not a real big guy, as you know. I'm not 6'4". So I didn't have any of those things. I don't have incredible IQ. So I did okay in school, but not great. There was just, I grew up as a little boy just thinking there was nothing special about me. And also, frankly, doubting whether there was a God. Like, why would there be a God if I have to live like this? Why would I have to be in this house? Why would my dad be like this? Because my dad was such a good man and a loving man and a smart man. And I admired him so much. And I just remember thinking, God, why would you give him this affliction that just is destroying our lives? You know, and it just gave me this, I think the overall word I would use, Erwin, is maybe sad. I think I was a sad child a lot of the time, a sad child. And I don't know that I was a child very long. I was kind of a little grown-up little guy. You'd met me at 8 or 9 years old. I don't think I behaved like a child anymore because of those things thrown upon me.
Yeah, I think a lot of times when we think of our childhood, we want to think of that childhood innocence or that irrational joy that we're supposed to experience when we're young. We don't think about having a job, having a career, worrying about the future, worrying about money, worrying about all the problems of the world. And you know, when you describe yourself as being a sad child, that means that the way of the world came on you sooner.
I agree, Erwin. I would say that that's true. You know, some of it may be my recollections, right? There were probably times, I'm sure even for you, there were times of joy. There were times where I was a little boy, but I can't find those in my memory. I can remember those the other times.
Yeah.
And that if you give me my emotion, even as we're talking, I can feel it sort of in my body right now, taking me back to those times, because it's someone I haven't been for a very long time. But that little guy, he's right here all the time. You know, he's right here. And through, you know, prayer and personal growth and learning some tools and stuff in my life, I can keep that, those emotions at bay most of the time, but I'm very familiar with them still.
Well, you said something really interesting, and I've noticed it before in some of our conversations where you talked about, in a sense, developing this this intuition at a very young age to be able to read a room, read an environment, read people. And years ago, my wife asked me, did I believe that humans were capable of almost anything? And I remember responding to her, I think we're capable of anything we need for survival.
Wow.
That so oftentimes what ends up becoming our genius is something that we develop in our struggle to survive. And it's actually the crisis in our life that begins to create the incubator for what later becomes our genius. And you've lived in the world of sales. You live in the world of really reading people and reading environments and situations. And this capacity that you needed to survive as a child actually became a huge talent that allowed you to thrive as an adult.
No question. And by the way, you have that same, you know, you and I are new friends, but I think one of the reasons I love you so much and I feel so connected to you in a very unusual way, one, you're special, but two is I think you have some of these similar traits. I think you and I are very similar in many, many ways. And I get emotional when I say that because it was born out of those things. And in hindsight, like, what a great blessing. I would not trade those times in my life for anything because it's helped me in small ways, connect with people that I probably otherwise would have never connected with and maybe helped them, you know, maybe given them some hope in their life. But certainly most of the things I have were born out of necessity. Now that you say that, I never really looked at it that way, but you're very much right about that.
There's this fascinating study of this, the Baka people. They're a tribe that their children have a PhD level knowledge of botany because they live in one of the most dangerous ecosystems in the world. And I've always been fascinated by the unlimited capacity of children to learn what is necessary to survive and to thrive. And I think what happens so many times is that we can become embittered because of the crises we face. You could have lived your life bitter because your father was an alcoholic, or you could have lived your life always as a victim because of what you had to face as a child. But instead, you stepped into that environment and let it shape you to make you stronger rather than to leave you paralyzed.
I think a lot of that, Erwin, has to do with the meaning you attach to an event. And if you don't take control of the meaning of what an event was in your life and you let it define you, or you let it be a negative attachment. You know, Mother Teresa had this amazing saying that she would say that one of her great blessings was that when she was with somebody, when they would pass away, if they were even in a car accident, let's say, it was one of the honors of her lifetime. Whereas most of us would say, my gosh, I saw this accident, someone passed away. It was a tragedy. Same event, she would take away a different meaning. And I think the other thing that for me is that I did tell myself as a little boy is that I function well in stress. I function well in chaos. The positive part of that, if I could be honest, is that I do function well when there's a lot of things going on and people are losing their heads. I can typically remain cool and make a good decision, whether that's business or family. Mm-hmm. The negative side of that, candidly, as I've gotten older and I really evaluated myself and what I do, I sometimes have a tendency to create chaos and stress in my life because it's a place that I'm familiar with. So even when things are going great and could be very peaceful, Ed Milet will find a way once in a while to create a little stress, a little chaos in his life because he functions well in it. And it's sort of a home for me. Mm-hmm. And so now that I'm kind of cognizant of that, although I function well in it, I'd prefer not to be in it if I can as much as possible. And I can go, oh, I'm doing it again. Here I go. And I'm kind of conscious of that. So I think that's something everybody should evaluate in themselves. Do you create some of these things repetitively because it's a pattern of yours as a child, or maybe in an adult, some type of an event, you just fall back into that pattern?
Yeah, it's interesting because a huge part of what motivated me to do this podcast, The Genius Of, is going through the process of writing my book, The Genius of Jesus. And in that book, I talk about how genius seems to be both touched by badness and touched by the divine. And in as much as the unique genius in each one of us, in many ways, is a reflection of being created in the image of God, it can also be a reflection of almost like the madness inside of us. And we have to be careful sometimes that we do not become too comfortable in the shadow of our genius. And I cannot wait
to read this, Erwin, because I cannot tell you how much, as you say that I know that to be true. Mm-hmm. I know that to be true. I also know that some of these geniuses we possess, if we're not careful, there can be a line where it is used for favor and good things and God's kingdom and increase in our lives. And some of these things we can use and spin them in their negative. The ability to influence people, for example.
Absolutely.
You know, that's a tremendous genius to have. How you utilize it is pretty darn important.
So I want to talk to you about the journey between your sadness and your meaning. Because you said you're a very sad child. And then you said what helped you through that is finding meaning in the pain.
Yes.
So somewhere between Ed, who was a sad child, and Ed Milet, who is a business icon, there's that person trying to figure out what's going on in their life. Can you unwrap a little bit of that journey from sadness to meaning?
I know exactly the first moment it happened. I'm not a believer that there's just a moment and everything changes necessarily, but there are moments. Like when I met that little brown girl in my kindergarten class, that was a moment, right? The next 80 years of my life, likely in this body, were defined by meeting that girl. So it was a big part of my life. Yes, I do know what happened. And again, it's God's blessing. So Erwin, you're going to believe this, but my dad gets sober, goes to his first AA meeting, first meeting to get sober. I'm now living on his couch. I flunked out of playing baseball. I had an injury. I'm living at home. I'm eating out of his refrigerator. He comes home from the meeting and goes, hey, I got you a job tomorrow morning. And I said, well, what is it? He goes, you don't get to decide what it is. You're eating out of my refrigerator. You're going there tomorrow morning. Anyway, he goes, it's called McKinley. I don't know what it is. It's in San Dimas. When you get there, tell him Tim sent you. I said, who's Tim? He goes, the guy next to me at the meeting last night. I show up. It's 6 a.m. I walk in. I say, hey, I'm Ed Milet. I'm here for the job. They go, what job? I go, I have no idea. I don't even know what you people do here. And the lady goes, well, we're an orphanage.
Wow.
I went, an orphanage? I said, well, I'm just supposed to come here and say Tim, and you're supposed to know what I'm doing. I'm not kidding you. And she goes, well, I have no idea what you're talking about. Come back when you know. And I go to get to the door, and I grab the door handle. I turn back. I go, well, I think he's probably a pretty big drinker because he was with my dad at an AA meeting last night. She goes, oh, drunk Tim. That's Cottage 8. I go, okay, Cottage 8. And I walk in. This is where my life changed. I walk into Cottage 8. It was McKinley Home for Boys. And there were 10 boys in there that became like my sons as a 21-year-old man. These boys were all molested by their family, parents incarcerated, or were dead. And they have these eyes, or when you have them, I have them. Anybody who comes from some kind of dysfunction, I just think we have these different eyes, just a little bit like, just love me, you know, just love me, care about me, believe in me. And these little boys turned and looked at me as they're getting ready for school. Who's the new guy? And my journey started there. These boys needed someone to love them, care about them, believe in them, and show them how to live a little better. And I'd take them to school. I'd pick them up. I was there to take them trick-or-treating. I was there when they opened their presents on Christmas Day. I wasn't prepared for any of this. Right? I didn't have any background. I'm not a psychologist. There's nothing like, but my heart changed. I went from being this kind of ego-driven baseball guy to, oh my gosh, I love making a difference. I love contributing. I love these boys. What I found as I got older, and by the way, my business career started there. I got hired into the financial firm while I worked there. And I stated that I stayed at McKinley for a year, but I found out, you know what most adults are saying to you when you meet them? Just love me, care about me, believe in me, show me how to live a little bit better. And so that's sort of been the work of my life since then. But my heart really changed in those moments. And in that couple years that I was at McKinley, it just shifted me into a different human. I got out of myself and into serving other people. And I found most of my insecurities dissipated when I stopped thinking about me all the time.
That's so
thinking
true.
About them.
Yeah. You know, for so many years, we've tried to help people see that the path to healing is actually serving. And so oftentimes when people come and they're wounded and broken, they want to be served and they cannot figure out why they can't be served enough to be healed. And actually the process of healing really happens when you begin serving other people, when you stop thinking about yourself. Because when you talk about being sad, I was one of those depressed kids, you know, and I was in a psychiatric chair by the time I was 12 years old. I was depressed all the time. I was that sad child. And I began realizing that a huge part of that sadness is that you're spending way too much time thinking about yourself. Yes. And you're just getting lost in this inner world of it's self-indulgence in the most negative expression.
And
the,
Amen.
In the moment you see someone who needs love more, when you went to the orphanage, all of a sudden you saw someone whose life in a sense was in worse shape than yours. It needed more help, more love than you. And it's just such a powerful transitional moment in your life.
Yes.
But you said at the same time, that's when you moved into financial services.
Yeah, isn't that crazy?
Now that was,
go ahead.
Was that something you thought, oh, I really want to be in financial services? Or was that just something that opened up?
That's hilarious. So you're going to laugh. This is so funny. Background. I get to have to go to this meeting for this financial company. Last thing I ever want to do. And you know me pretty well by now. Like I'm not a math person by any means, nor was I a business major in college. I was a communication major. So I walk into this meeting and the gentleman giving the meeting, you have to have my background. I flunked chemistry. In fact, I got a D in chemistry because they eventually just wanted to get me out so I could go play college baseball. So I'm the compound chart. All these things are still running in the back of my head, right? So I go to this financial meeting. This guy's putting all these things up on the screen, compound interest and rules of 70. And I'm like, oh man, this is a chemistry deal. He was a Filipino gentleman with a very heavy accent that was sort of pitching the firm. And I thought he was saying acid management, but what he was saying was, asset management, but I don't get any of this. And I'm seeing these compounds up there. And then at the end, he goes, but you can do this. You can help people. We're changing the world. There's big money to be made. We recognize you. There's competition. I'm like, well, I like that part. I call my girlfriend at the time, who's now my wife. I said, babe, they said we can do this together. I don't have any idea what it is, but I'm going to do the people and the competition and all that stuff. I need you to do the chemistry piece. And we go back into the interview, Erwin, and my wife can't tell a lie. I can't, but I'm poker facing. We figure out about 10 minutes in, this was asset management, financial. And she goes, you dummy. So not chemistry, it's financial. What did you guys go? I thought he said acid. I'm sorry. So I started this kind of prolific financial career, having no idea what the heck I was getting into initially. And then obviously I took, if you call it genius, I took the things that I do well, communicate. Mm-hmm. I'm an intense person. Mm-hmm. I'm pretty compassionate. You know, I'm a hard worker. I care. I kind of took what I was doing at McKinley. And the problem was there when I started to really make money and I was in this debate, this conflicted part of me where I was like, well, I'm making this money part-time in the financial thing. I'm making $6 an hour working at the orphanage. Mm-hmm. But I finally concluded, you know, I could go help the parents of people like these children and maybe their families will stay together. And you know what? If God will bless me with a bunch of resources, I'll go do things for thousands of children that I could only do for these 10. And so it was a difficult decision, but I finally made the transition into the business world.
Wow. You know, it's interesting because I feel like so oftentimes when people talk about finding their destiny or their calling or their purpose, that a lot of times it still sounds pretty self-indulgent. It's still about my destiny, my calling, my purpose. Mm-hmm. And ironically, it sounds like you just picked the opportunity in front of you and brought all of yourself into it. And there's some sense where you didn't choose financial services. They just sort of chose you and it gave you the platform to actually begin to express your genius.
100%. And I also believe that, you know, the other thing, I think sometimes I didn't have a lot of options. And I think there's a lot of people listening to think, well, I don't have a lot of options. So, you know, maybe there's no genius in me. Right. I didn't have a lot of options. I wasn't anything special. Mm-hmm. But you know what? I found something once I started. I'm like, I like how this is what happened, Erwin. I like how I feel about the difference I'm making for other people here. Mm. I think there's an element of that that's somewhat self-indulgent. In other words, I felt better about me when I could make a difference for another person. And I think what it was doing is holding off at bay that other person you were referring to. But here's the crazy thing, and I know it's been true for you too. I've never gotten tired of it. Mm. Everything else in my life that's been for me, I want to get in a house. I want to get a jet. I want to get some money. I get tired. It wears out. It's people say, well, money won't make you happy. Well, that's a lie. That's not true. Money can temporarily make you happy. You ever buy a new pair of shoes or I got some of your clothes, it feel pretty darn good, right? What it will never do is fulfill you.
Right.
And there's a huge difference between happiness and fulfillment. Mm-hmm. And the fulfilling part of my life has been other human beings, other people that I've been able to make a connection with. And by the way, they've helped me tremendously. Mm-hmm. Do you know how many times to this day, I can't even talk about it. How many times to this day, times a month, I will think about walking through that door at McKinley or little Jose or little Joseph or little Raul that I, to this day, they're all in my life now. They're grown men, but I think about that time all the time because it altered me. Mm. So I think about them all the time.
You know, it's funny. Years ago, when I used to do a lot more business consulting, I had this group of young entrepreneurs come to me. And as I was walking through like why they were doing what they were doing, they said, we want to be rich. And I said, so why do you want to be rich? And they said, so we can be free to do whatever we want to do. And I said, so what do you want to do? and they said, we don't know yet. You know, we just want to be rich so we can do whatever it is that we want to do. And I said, if you don't even know what you want to do now, and what makes you think that money is going to somehow give you the insight to know what you want to do then? And I think the tragedy sometimes is that people think that creating wealth will actually create their freedom.
Yes.
But if you don't even know why you're doing what you're doing, you won't, all the money in the world can't buy you your why.
Erwin, I know more people with money that live in more fear now of losing it than they do of focusing on the freedom of having it. Mm. I can tell you that because I live near them, right? I'm blessed to live in nice places. And I can also tell you that my dad used to tell me as I was starting to accumulate some money, but I was working on me. You know, I'd found my faith. I had, you know, started to read the word. I had started, and also in addition to that, working on things in my mind simultaneously, right? Techniques and thoughts and reading good books and feeding my spirit. And my dad would always tell me, if you can't be happy where you are now, you're taking you to that big mansion you think you want to buy. And it's going to be the same guy. And all you're going to want to do, you're going to rearrange the furniture. And it's going to be that same man sitting there staring at the wall. And so, and it was so profound that I also come from a family who puts zero priority on material things, zero priority, nor does my wife. So I think that kept me somewhat grounded. And I have had times in my life where I've accumulated abundance and not still, I've gone through stages or phases like human beings do. I have a relationship with myself. I have a relationship with God. These are relationships. Sometimes they're better than others, right? These relationships ebb and flow. But I've certainly had times, even after I accumulated money and supposedly know all these lessons, where I've screwed these things up as well. But I do sort of have a belief system, a standard by which I try to live my life that sort of serves me, I think, most of the time.
Now, I hope it's okay for me to say this, but you have, what, 30-something different companies that you're involved in?
I do.
And I know you, I don't know if you make that really publicly or not.
But, not a lot, but that's okay.
For a person to be successful with one company, that's an extraordinary thing. If you can do it two or three times, that's quite impressive. But the fact that you have your fingerprint on 30 plus different companies, it tells me that you've simplified things. Because a lot of times what happens is people think that genius makes things more complicated, but actually, genius simplifies things. And yes, you begin to see the things that actually matter, and you're less and less confused by all the peripheral things that really don't matter. If I were to ask you, Ed, what would be the core of that genius that you're able to take from company to company, from challenge to challenge, from crisis to crisis? What's the core essence of that genius? How would you describe that?
I love that you use the word genius. I've always used giftedness. I think if you ask anybody who knew me in business, they say, Ed has an unusual confidence and belief system in other people's genius. In other words, I surround myself and I take full advantage, if you want to look at it that way, of the genius. I'm pretty good, Erwin, at identifying the genius traits in other people. Sometimes things they've intuitively thought about themselves most of their life, but no one's ever pointed it out and no one's ever attached it to a role or a job. So as a leader, I feel like my job in an organization is to find the genius in somebody, get them to believe that that's part of their genius. Because I think we intuitively know once it's pointed out to us, you know what? I am compassionate. You know what? I do care. I am funny. I am beautiful. I am resilient. These geniuses, we sort of know. But sometimes if another person says, hey, this is a genius of yours, I call it a gift, but genius is a much better word. This is a genius of yours. And then I get them to apply that and I trust it. And I don't be overboard, but it is a part of my faith in my businesses in that I really believe God created each of us special. I really believe this. I truly believe it. And so I will fully empower somebody to utilize their genius in my businesses. That would be a major part. I think anyone will tell you that in an unusual amount. They're accountable. I monitor it. We report to one another, but I let you lead. I let you make decisions. And the other thing I would say is that I'm a pretty good visionary at selling the vision of where we're going in each of these companies. This is where we're going. I'm willing to repeat it over and over again. I'm willing to every way I can to get the word out of what our cause. I often say that I'm evangelical about our mission as a company in each one of these companies. I'm enrolling people in the vision of the business and the difference we make. And it is never about profitability. It is always about the cause. The profitability, all that stuff, it'll wear out on people. The cause, people will continue to fight for over and over. And then maybe the third thing is I'm decisive. I do not buy into the theory that this is the right decision all the time and this one won't work. You know what? I've found oftentimes in business, both could work. Both can work. In other words, there's right and wrong in life. I'm not saying that.
Sure.
What I'm saying is, we're going to call this shot or we're going to call this shot. So people are so fearful. What if I make the wrong shot? What if I make the wrong decision? Here's the truth. If you've got great geniuses around you and you're committed to your vision and you're good people, you can most of the time make either one work eventually. It's not a death sentence. And so I'm not afraid to make a decision because I'm not afraid that it might be wrong. We can course correct. We can come back. I'm willing as a leader, as a father, as a friend to go, hey, I made a mistake. I made the wrong decision. You know what? We're going to fix this. I'm not perfect, but I'm not afraid. I'm a pretty decisive person, typically.
I love that because I think about how if you were Mozart and your genius was music, but now what required was mathematics, a lot of people would say, I'm Mozart, so I'm not going to hire Einstein. And right. Or if you needed to create a work of art, you'd go, I'm Mozart, so I'm not going to hire Picasso. And so even our genius can become the ceiling. It can become the lid on our success.
Wow. Is that not true? Wow.
And I think what I'm hearing you say, and you wouldn't say it like this, but you're a Picasso who's not intimidated by teaming with a Mozart and teaming with an Einstein and teaming with a Da Vinci, because you want their genius to actually become a chemical compound with your genius to create something you couldn't by yourself.
I'm actually fascinated by them. Mm-hmm. I'm interested in them. Do you know what I mean? I don't want everyone around me to be me. I'm our little group of men that, you know, that we've gathered with a couple of times and that I'm fascinated by these guys. Like they're different than me. And so I want to empower people. I'm just this, it's amazing that you wrote the book on this topic because I've used a different terminology, but like it has been the key to any success that I may have had is really believing that people have a genius in them, that they have a giftedness in them. And I don't, giftedness sometimes I think may be wrong because it gives this connotation that you have to work at getting better at it.
Yeah.
Maybe we call it a proclivity, but it certainly becomes a genius when it's manifested for the good of others. No question about it. And I think that's definitely the root. I'm fascinated by people. And I love, if I'm in an Uber, my drives my wife crazy. I want to talk to the driver. Where are you from? And she'll tell you within 30 minutes, I'm telling them they're genius. You know, I want to know. I just had a guy pick me up just really quick. This guy picked me up from Tel Aviv. Older gentleman, you'd get in, his car was pretty beat up, wasn't very clean. Frankly, he wasn't very clean. You know, he hadn't shaved in a long time. And you would make an assessment about this person. We start talking, came to this country. He's got a daughter at Yale, a son that graduated from Harvard, another one that's going to Penn. Why is he driving the Uber? He's driving the Uber to pay their tuition. He's driving the Uber to pay their tuition. He's retired now and he's got children that young because he married, his first wife passed away. Anyway, this guy's genius is how much he loves his family, what he's willing to do for his family. This is a beautiful man. I think I'm so blessed I got the 30 minutes with him. So that's sort of what I do in business, like I would do in an Uber. I do it in the interview when I hire you.
All right. So there are people listening right now and they go, oh, Ed Milet, please identify the genius in me and help unlock it. But I want to go to the other side for a moment. You've had to have interacted and worked and even cared about people who never really stepped into their genius. And you could see it, but maybe they could never see it for themselves, or they could or never make the choices to actualize that genius at the highest level. What would you say are some of the key things that keep a person from stepping into their own personal genius?
It's a great question. I think there's a lack of identity or confidence that they really have it. A fear of the power of it is the other side of it. Wow. You know, to some extent, there's an identity we all carry for ourselves. It's like it's kind of like a thermostat sitting on the wall of our life. And I feel like there's this genius that could be 150 degrees. But if we believe we're a 75 degreer, no matter how good our results start to get, we turn the air conditioner of our life back down somehow and cool it back down to what we believe we deserve.
Wow.
And I've watched this happen over and over again in people's lives. You call it self-sabotage, or maybe you really believe you don't deserve abundance, but business starts to go pretty well. You know this, you've seen this, everyone, and people too. Wow, things are going really, really well. A year later, you come back and they're back at 75 degrees again. They've unconsciously cooled it back down again. Is that because they're afraid of what that might do to them? Is it because they just don't believe they deserve it and they're worth it? You've seen people who have 75 degrees of fitness. Maybe they're a little bit overweight and you see them and all of a sudden, my gosh, you look amazing. You've lost 25 pounds. What did you do? Oh, I'm doing this or that. Or you see them a year later, they've gained it back plus 5 pounds because they cooled their life back down. So I think simultaneously with having this genius in us and identifying it is starting to believe that we can increase our thermostat setting of our life, that we deserve it, that we're worthy of it. In my case, my prayer most evenings is that God wants this in my life. That when I look at my son, Max, I feel like magnified by a billion times. That's how God looks at me. I want my son to be happy. I want him to contribute. I want him to make a difference. I want him to use this genius he's got to make a difference in other people's lives, to fulfill his heart, right? So I want that for him. I have to assume my Father in heaven wants that for me. Mm. And so I remind myself of this regularly. The higher, if we climb high in life, you've climbed so high with all the books and the people you've reached in your life and your ministry and all the different things you've done. You know, I think sometimes the higher we climb, we better work on that identity. Mm-hmm. And that identity for me is that I just really believe that God's brought me this far. He wants me to continue. He wants me to do more. He wants me to grow. So many people, I just don't think believe that. And they put that air conditioner on and it's a vicious cycle in their life.
Mm. Your son's name is Max.
That's correct.
And you wrote a book called Maxed Out.
I did.
any connection between the two?
Very, very much so. So the name came from, we're trying to figure out what to call him. And about 3 days before he was born, I watched Gladiator and it was Maximus. I said, all right, that's a guy name. All right, yep. We'll go with Max. And then this little boy came out. It's interesting in life. You know, my son's very different than me. Very different than me. Mm. He's more kind than me. He's smarter than me. He's not quite, it doesn't burn quite as hot as his dad. You know what I mean? I got this thing, you know. And it was interesting when he was a little boy, me figuring out how to love this boy even more that wasn't like me, if that makes any sense. Mm-hmm. I think sometimes as parents, you know, we connect easier with the child who's most like us. Mm. Max is my best friend now. Mm. He's my, you know, my family is, but Max and I are very, very tight.
Sure.
And so when I wrote Max out, I really wrote that book because of sort of the theory of our relationship is, we're always trying to max out our fun, max out our experience, max out our contribution, max out our faith, max out different things. And that came from his name. But the blessing in my life with my son, because my daughter's very much like me, my son is a great lesson as a parent, is we often like people like us. Mm-hmm. We often surround ourselves with people like us. But the beauty of life, if we use this word genius, is to surround ourselves with different types of geniuses.
Absolutely.
Because that gives our life variety. Like that neighborhood I grew up in. And my son is one of the first people. If you looked at my business life, Erwin, he's 19 years ago, most of these geniuses that ran my businesses looked, talked, and sounded a lot like me. It was just a blind spot for me. I liked them, that's who I'd hire. Mm. Once I had this little precious boy, he was just smarter, more patient, kinder, softer in many ways, but stronger inside than me. It made me realize there's lots of other geniuses in the world that I should have in my life and in my businesses. So Max has had a lot to do in a way he had no idea he did with my business success because I love these other geniuses and people.
Mm. Speaking of other geniuses, what's is there any significant life lesson that stands out to you that you've learned from someone else?
Yes, sure. My dad, ironically, I watched my dad. I believe humans can change.
Mm.
And I didn't believe that when I was young. I believe humans can change dramatically.
You know, I think you might be in the minority because I keep hearing people say, people don't change, people don't change, people don't change. Yeah. And I'm with you, Ed, because I've changed. And so I have to believe people can change because I've changed.
Same here. And I watched a man fight for his family to get sober to control his life. Mm-hmm. I watched a man who was pretty angry guy turn into the kindest man. The most gentle man, the most giving man. And the person that I, by far in my life, is the best man I've ever known is my dad. Mm. If you'd have asked me that at 15, he wouldn't have been on that list. But you'd have asked me, I watched this human being literally transform themselves and become a completely, I believe that man was always in there.
Yeah.
That's a part of his genius, but he found him. And he worked on it and it grew and grew and grew. And my dad is the most amazing person I've ever known, helped thousands of people get sober, was in thousands of people's lives, just remarkable. Mm. So a great life lesson for me. It's why I do this. If you think about it, I'm an entrepreneur, but really what I try to be is somebody who can help you believe you can change your life through the different tools and resources, foundation of faith. And that's because of my dad. So my life lesson is my father in many, wow. many ways. Now, sometimes our life lessons is observing someone in our life that we don't want to be like. Mm-hmm. That was the first half of my dad's life.
Wow.
He spent 40 years as one human being. He spent the second 40 years as a completely different person. And so that's the life lesson for me. People can change.
Oh, that's so, so profound. And yeah, I've always felt part of what motivates even this podcast is that for so many people, their genius is trapped underneath the rubble of their failures and of their fears and of their regrets. And it, sometimes it takes having other people come into your life and begin to pull the boulders aside so that you can begin to rediscover who you are. I cannot help but imagine that a huge part of your dad's motivation to be a changed man was his love for you and watching you become the man that you have become. And it's kind of a beautiful thing to, to see that in some ways, you know, all of us are connected to each other, whether we like it or not. When someone says they're not hurting anybody except themselves, they're living in an illusion. And you know, you're tied by a rope to your father and he can try to pull you under into whatever choices he made. And at the same time, it's almost like you can pull him forward by the choices that you made. And it's just a great reminder that when we don't give up on each other, we don't just save ourselves, we save those that we love.
It's amazing. So I was going to share something with you I just remembered along those lines. Wow, Irwin, geez. Every time you talk to me, something like that breaks through for me. My dad told me he was getting sober. I think it was like 17. We were at a drive-thru at a Carl's Jr. And it was for my birthday. Actually, you know what my dad's sobriety date is? This is so funny. 4/11. Or not 4/11. What's the pot date? What do they call it? His birthday's 4/11. What is the weed day? You know, whatever the national pot day is the day my dad got sober.
420.
Yeah. My dad's sobriety date is 420. So for the last 40 years of my life, my dad would not celebrate his birthday on his birthday. He would celebrate it on his sobriety birthday.
Oh, wow.
And it was 420, but I didn't realize what 420 was because I've never smoked pot till a couple of years ago. And my buddy told me, he goes, you realize your dad got sober on National Weed Day. I said, I had no idea. But I remember when my dad, we were at a Carl's Jr. And my dad said, hey, just want you to know, I'm gonna go away for a few days and I'm gonna get sober for our family. Now my dad had tried many, many times, but he had never told me he was going to do it. And I'll never forget this. I wasn't a very older guy, but I would share this with your audience because I'll never forget. This was literally the Holy Spirit, because it wasn't me. I said, hey dad, you know, your past does not disqualify you from being happy in the future. I have no idea where that came out of me. But your past doesn't disqualify you. And my dad cried. I only saw my dad cry twice. And that was one of the times he cried. And it was this little car at Carl's Jr.
Wow.
And he goes, I'm never going to forget that. And since you just said what you said, I think we carry around these boulders. It's almost like a weapon we use against ourselves. We keep hurting ourselves. I did this. Yeah. I had this failure. I hurt this person. I made this mistake. You're just going to keep hurting yourself with it. These are these bags you carry. Put them down. Aren't you tired of carrying these bags around with you of your past? Set them down. Write a new chapter of your life. You know, put the bags down. That doesn't disqualify you. It doesn't disqualify you from being happy and successful and making a difference. It does not disqualify you. And my dad proved that. And so I would want to share that with everybody today.
That's so, so good. Ed, your life is, it's a tapestry of adventure and success, entrepreneurship to huge risk and creation. But when you come to the end of your life, how do you want to be remembered?
I won't be probably remembered, but I want, obviously, you know,
you
I want
will
to
be
think,
remembered. I will not let that stand well, in the universe.
If you're here, I want to make sure that I answer that fully. By the way, I'll probably go before you. So please, talk about me a lot when I'm done. What I mean by that, I want the Lord to look at me and say, well done, good and faithful servant. I want that really badly. But I have this other hallucination that I kind of live by, and it's my version. And so I do think about this. I'm sort of known for what I'm about to tell you. But when I was 45, I went to dinner. My daughter's the one like me. And we walk in. I'd started to kind of get more well-known in the public space. And it's my birthday. And my daughter snaps at me at dinner. She says, Dad, what's up with this midlife crisis? And I said, what, honey? She goes, the midlife crisis. You know, you're on social media, you're taking selfies, you're kind of dyeing your beard now. I don't know what's going on with you, but I think you're going through a midlife crisis. And I said, you know what, Bella, I am. But I was in a crisis. I had a young life crisis too. Mm. And I had a 30-year-old crisis. I said, daddy wants to replace himself every year. So the Max was little. We were at this car wash. This man every weekend was there reading the newspaper. Or when he says to me one time, he says, how old's your little boy? And I said, he's six. And he goes, well, enjoy the six-year-old, because when he turns seven, that six-year-old's gone forever.
Mm.
Which as parents, we know that to be true. And yeah, when he turns eight, the seven-year-old's gone. And I didn't mean to be flippant. I don't know where this came from. I said to him, sir, when did that process stop for you? What age? And he kind of put the paper down. He looks at me, he goes, what? I said, when did you stop replacing yourself every year?
Mm.
And he says, I don't know. I said, you should figure that out. And for me, Bella, as I'm talking to her, I've tried to do that every year of my life. That daddy's, now I'm 50. That 49-year-old should be gone forever. Not his principles, not his standards, not those things, but that version of me should be upgraded and improved. Because here's what I feel like. When I pass away, I want to get there with the Lord to go, well done, Eddie. You knocked it out of the park. Good and faithful servant. But I think he goes, by the way, remember that genius I created? This is who you could have been. I'd like you to meet him.
Mm.
And the genius version of me is standing there. The things I could have done, the places I could have gone, the memories we could have had, the accomplishments, the contribution, the way I feel, the way other people felt, the difference I made in the world. I want you to meet him, Eddie. And when I meet that guy, I want to go, I caught you. Mm. I caught you, man. And he goes, I've been watching you. You did it, man. Congratulations. To me, heaven, a version of heaven, Irwin, is me catching that guy.
Mm.
A version of hell is I meet him and we're total strangers.
Wow.
I didn't make that difference. I didn't make the contributions. I didn't have the memories. We didn't have the moments. And I understand the principle of my faith is that I'm accepted. I understand that. I understand that Christ died for my sins. I'm not going anywhere near that. But everyone knows what I'm talking about,
mm-hmm.
right? I'm saved by the grace of God, okay? But I want to be clear about this. I still want to catch that guy. God made me with a purpose. He made you with a purpose. He made you with a genius, to speak your language, Irwin. I think we have it's not a responsibility. It's a pleasure. It's fulfilling something in us, in our heart. It's an expression of our spirit to fulfill that genius. And when my breaths in this body are done, I want to have done that. No pun intended, maxed out. I want to have maxed out. And I don't want to meet that guy and be complete strangers, because God put people in my path. I walked into McKinley for a reason. I've had business failures for a reason. I met that little brown girl for a reason, right? I met the people that I met in the Uber the other day for a reason. And so I want to be the fullest expression of me, hopefully a reflection of God's goodness in people's lives by using the genius he gave me. And so that's a version of heaven in my mind while I'm here on earth right now. So that's sort of what I'd like to be remembered by, I guess, if I'm going to be remembered.
I love that. And that, by the way, every time I'm around you, I want to become a better version of myself. And I think that's a part of your genius, is inspiring everyone around you to not settle for less. And
so do you.
And I think the person who's only listening superficially will think it's about money.
No.
And when it's really about living your life with fullness and to be fully present, to be fully alive, and to not waste any time. And one of the things that you and I have in common is that we both have a morbid sense of death.
We do.
We are both ancient samurai.
And, you're right.
Get up each day saying, right, today is a good day to die.
Yes. Yes.
And how did that develop in you? Because you do have that sense of both being fully alive and aware of the temporary nature of this life.
I wish I knew exactly where it came from, but if I'm being candid, sometimes I would close that door as a little boy in my room, cause I could hide in there, Irwin.
Mm.
And I would contemplate why we exist. Just like you did when you were searching for those answers. That's why I connect with you so deeply. And I would just think, is there a purpose to being here? Mm. And I thought about death quite a bit. Now, as I've read, by the way, I've had some child psychologists and people on my show, they tell me that children often think about death, but that there becomes a point if they have a beautiful upbringing where they begin to think more about other things. You and I weren't afforded those other things. And so I think I stayed in those thoughts that are common for children, by the way, to think about death. They wonder, where did I come from? When does this end? That's a normal thing for a child. I just think for me, sitting in that room, hoping there wasn't a bunch of chaos going on downstairs in my home, I thought a lot about that in my life. And for some reason, this is what's bizarre. It gives me comfort to think about it. It gives me energy. It gives me inspiration. Mm-hmm. It gives me the, it's oftentimes my contemplation of death that makes me so grateful for this life. Mm-hmm. And so it's not been something that's been detrimental to me, nor has it been for you. It's been actually the opposite. It's a trigger, a mechanism, a pattern, a thought that has served me very well. Now I'm a 50-year-old man who's had probably millions of thoughts about my death. I don't obsess about like I'm going to die, but I certainly evaluate if I did, what was this story the one I wanted? Was this book of my life the one that God destined for me? Did I make the right decisions? You know, what are the mistakes I've made? So certainly I think about that. I don't know the moment it happened, but I definitely know it's been millions of thoughts about it.
So good. All right. Someone's listening right now and they're inspired. They're motivated. They want to step into their greatness. They want to step into their genius. They want to begin to move forward and to live their life maxed out in the language that you would use.
Yes.
Where do they start?
Well, the first thing is start, get moving. So I can't teach you, nor can Erwin, how to drive a parked car. You have to get moving. There's got to be some kind of motion. So you've got to put something into motion. Clearly, you have to have some idea, some vision of what you would like to accomplish. But I don't believe it has to be in its entirety. Mm-hmm. You know, if you asked Henry Ford when he started Ford Motor Company, hey, you're going to build this car thing? Like, who's going to fix them? Where are the tires going to come from? How are they going to get fuel eventually? What if you'd had a thought through every single step you had to take in order to make that vision a reality? Steve Wozniak, who is a founder of Apple, is a very good friend. Had him to some of my events. They started that thinking as a board company. They had no idea there was going to be an iPhone or even the internet, or that they were going to be the most influential company maybe of all time. What if when they started that board company, they thought through all of the things that could go wrong or that they didn't know? So stop focusing on all that you don't have, the scarcity, because there's a whole bunch of stuff you don't know, can't have, won't have. And no, you don't know everything. But know this, as someone who's been down the road a little bit, God has this amazing ability that once you get into a room and you get into a space and you're busting your tail and you're working hard, He shows you the doorway into the next one. And when you step into that room, you've got more preparedness, more resources, more genius coming out of you than you ever imagined. In fact, that genius you have, the more you step through these doors, the more magnified it becomes, the more beautiful it becomes. Its full blossom could become into frame if you'll keep stepping through these doors. So where would I start? I'd get moving. I'd get some idea of what I want to do. If I want to start a business, start it. Get something on eBay. Type up a business plan. Get a mentor, follow some other podcasts, follow Erwin. When Erwin's book comes out, you better get that thing, right? I would just start somewhere. Your deal is this, everybody. You know what to do. You keep telling yourself you don't know what to do and have no idea because that's your defense mechanism for trying. You know what to do. You know what you need to do next. You probably got to write some goals down. You probably got to get a vision. Maybe you got to call somebody and enlist them. Maybe you got to get on your knees and pray about getting clear on where you want to go and what you want to do. So this lack of resourcefulness that we have as humans. I don't know how much baloney. Yes, you do. There's an internet. There's millions of experts out there. I do not accept that you don't know that. You know better than that. Get in motion, get moving, make some mistakes, get back up. And you know what? You're going to find out this expression of your genius starts to come out of you. But if you're not moving, if you're not serving other people, it stays suppressed. It stays small. I don't believe any of you were born in your life to live small. I'm not talking about millions of dollars. I have a sister who's blind, Erwin. She's diabetic. She lost her vision. She's a preschool teacher. I don't know what Andrea makes a year, but it's probably $40,000 a year. She's a genius with children. She's living an extraordinary life. She's been a school teacher now for 20 years. She's incredible at it. She started out as a school teacher to be a teacher's aide until she got her real job, so to speak. But she got moving, and when she got there, she fell in love with it and has never left. I haven't lived a better or worse life than her. I'm not more or less than a genius because I have more houses than my sister. She's living her genius because she got moving. And she's a lot better at it now than when she was in the beginning. So I just say, get moving, make a plan, execute a little bit, make some mistakes. If you're a person of faith, here's what blows my mind. Last thing, Irwin, if you are a person of faith, and if you're listening to Irwin, you may be, right? You may not be. Here's the thing. I see so many people, Irwin, they got God with them at Bible study on Wednesday. God's with them at church on Sunday, but somehow when they wake up Monday morning and they got to go become an entrepreneur or they walk into the business world, now they're alone. You're alone. Well, you know what? You take that power out of your life. You take God out of your life. You take the Holy Spirit out of your life. You take that genius out of your life. It is scary. So I would just suggest to you, you have that same God with you on Monday morning. You have that same Father in heaven on Monday morning with you. When you walk into a boardroom or a meeting, or you're making that business plan, you'll be amazed at the genius that'll flow out of you. But maybe some of you were raised with this mindset that, well, that stuff's not for God. Baloney. It absolutely is for God. You're supposed to help people with the business you have. You're supposed to help people with your life, with your hobby, with your craft, with your charity, with whatever you're doing. So I would just say, enroll God in your vision. I say this often, and I don't say this just because Irwin leads a big old church. My business partner is God. Here's the truth. The reason some of my answers are what they are, because there's entire times, Irwin, in my business career where I was busting my tail, doing everything you're supposed to do, and it still didn't go well. And there's other times in my career where I wake up and 90 days later, we're in a whole different place. And I can't explain it to you. Well, the only thing I could feel like, the Lord just picked me up during those times, put me on his shoulders, carried me for a while, set me back down in a better spot. And I'm a big believer in the parable of the sower. I just believe this. You keep planting enough seeds. You know, look, the birds are going to get a few of them, right? The weather's going to get a little bit of them. But there's a harvest. But if you're not planting any seeds, there's no harvest. You got to get to planting some seeds. So that's what I would say.
Oh, well, that's more than enough. And that is so inspiring. And, you know, just for fun, just a few random thoughts. Any historical geniuses inspired you throughout your life?
Yeah, a few of them are super random. Well, obviously, you and I believe that Jesus is the greatest genius, so that's absolutely a huge one. But there's a guy named Napoleon Hill that wrote a book called Think and Grow Rich. He's a very simple man who, you know, I just believe is a genius. Inspired me because he wasn't the king. He was like a king maker. He was somebody that was a kingmaker. Also, I love great music. And so my dad got me later in life into classical music. And that's a very easy to identify genius in somebody.
Sure.
So I have a very eclectic taste, but like, I love Beethoven. Like I love Beethoven. That was a true genius. But I also love Nat King Cole. I love Frank Sinatra. Like I just had Sinatra on before we started, right? I had the chairman of the board go. Right. I'm a music lover. I Adele is my neighbor and she's in her backyard. Imagine this, Irwin, you have Adele in her backyard singing karaoke some nights. And it's this just angelic, amazing voice. I'm sitting there across the fairway like, Lord, are you serious? I'm getting Adele again tonight. Now, sometimes it's 3 o'clock in the morning. I want to go over there and pipe her down. But so these musical geniuses for me have been the most obvious expression of genius. And then my hero, other than my dad, I think you know, was Dr. King. I wrote my dissertation in college on Martin Luther King. Why do I love Dr. King so much? Because he was a flawed man. See, God used a sinner for good in the world. And it's a great example because we're all sinners. See, a lot of people that read about Dr. King, they don't know this guy, you know, Dr. King had an interesting journey sometimes, right?
Yeah.
But he's the most transformational figure and has made the greatest difference as a human being probably on planet Earth in the last 100 years or more. Why? Because he used his genius, his incredible vision, his incredible humility, his incredible oratory skills, his ability to enroll people in a vision, right? His relentless work ethic, his ability to stay calm under pressure and duress. He had a high degree of what I call equanimity. He learned how to stay calm under duress. And so to me, that's one of the great geniuses. Like me, he's a sinner. He's made mistakes, right? All of us have. And I think when we look at these heroes of ours, these geniuses, sometimes we think, well, this part of them isn't perfect. Or we mistakenly think they are perfect and we're not like them. And the more I read about Dr. King, I'm very much like him in many ways. He made his mistakes. I've made my mistakes. But he made a huge difference in the world. And so probably of all the geniuses, non-musical, Dr. King has inspired me the most because I see some of my potential giftedness or genius similar to his in a very small way.
What a wonderful, unexpected array of individuals. It's really, really beautiful. Beethoven was the first album I ever had when I was around 8 years old. And so I grew up with classical music and of course have great admiration for Dr. King and such a relevant icon for this moment in history as well. And
that's how you know someone's a genius. Don't you think his work is timeless? His message is timeless. Wouldn't it be wonderful if another Dr. King emerged right now in our culture? We so could use that right now. And so maybe hundreds of them could emerge, but yeah.
I love that because when you think of geniuses, oftentimes you think in the world of physics or in the world of science or botany or music or art, but MLK Jr. was a genius when it comes to moving us toward human ideals. And, you know, when he spoke about, you know, social justice and equality and really that's at the core of the genius of Jesus is that the greatest expression of genius is when we become fully human and when we realize that the essence of our humanity is the most important aspect of who we are, more than our gifting, our talent, our intelligence, our appearance. And we need to take some time and focus on the essence of who we are.
And so true.
Ed, I loved this conversation and I want to thank you so, so much for saying yes and being a guest on my podcast and helping me launch our first episode of The Genius Of.
It's my honor. And okay, now that we're done, I will tell you, turns out you're anointed at this too. So everything's going to be good. Thank you, brother.
Hey, love you. Talk to you soon. Love you. All right. God bless. Okay. Thank you so much for joining me for today's episode. I want to thank Ed Mylett for sharing his genius with us. I want to encourage you to pick up his book, Max Out Your Life, Strategies for Becoming an Elite Performer. And I want to encourage you to pick up my book, The Genius of Jesus, releasing September 14th, and begin to discover the genius within you. Let me encourage you to subscribe to The Genius of Podcasts on Apple Podcasts and leave a review. If you're watching on YouTube, leave a comment, leave a review. Let us know what part of the conversation has made an impact on your life. And if there's a special guest you would love for me to interview, let me know. I want to thank you so much for joining me today. And remember, every episode of The Genius Of has one singular intention, to unwrap the genius within you.